Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. With another homemade radio show broadcasting from my living room. I've had much advice, I appreciate it, from the listeners about how to improve the sound, and I'm working on it, like I said last week. A lot of it has to do with getting a new microphone, and I have to find the right one to invest in, aside from the cheap Best Buy microphone that I got along with this monitor that goes with the Skype outfit that I got. So I'm looking into it. I was thinking about Passover and Easter. And first of all, I want to say whatever I have to say today, apologies in advance to anyone who is Jewish or Christian or who has any knowledge of the history of their own religion or any religion. I am liable to quote things or make statements that are completely inaccurate. And feel free to get in touch with me on my website, Federfiles, FederFiles.com. And let me know if I've gone way off the deep end. And so that's one thing. The other thing is that I am sadly, and I have to say sadly, for various complicated reasons, so unaffiliated with my own religion. Not with the fact that I'm Jewish, which is a separate thing in a way. Although for some people, it's not separate at all. For some people, it's one and the same. And you can't really call yourself Jewish unless you are religious and you observe the holidays and you, you know, you do go to daily services, that kind of thing. But still, there's a lot of people who aren't religious like me, who wishes they were religious, by the way, in my old age, as I've mentioned many times in the last year or two. But who knows? Maybe there's no atheist in the foxhole, and I'm, you know, getting older now and definitely halfway into the foxhole, so, or halfway out of it. But foxholes are a part of my life, so who knows? Maybe I will, maybe I'll come to Jesus, you know? Maybe I'll become a religious Jew in the end. I mean, I would choose Judaism. I would. It's the way I was brought up. Seems like the right thing. Seems kosher. But so unaffiliated, anyhow, am I from my own Judaism that when I went to explain a little bit about Passover to people, when I wanted to get a little statement about Passover to explain what it is, I couldn't just make it up myself. I mean, I could make it up myself, but I doubted my ability to get it right. So I went to Wikipedia. I know it's shameful. What can I tell you? but here's Passover, according to Wikipedia, somewhat edited, of course. The Jewish people celebrate Passover as a commemoration of their liberation by God from slavery in Egypt and their freedom as a nation under the leadership of Moses. It commemorates the story of the Exodus as described in the Hebrew Bible, especially in the book of Exodus, in which the Israelites were freed from slavery in Egypt. According to standard biblical chronology, whatever that is, this event would have taken place at about 1300 BCE, before the Christian era. We used to say BC. We used to say AD and BC, but I guess that's been replaced, before the Christian era. Later on, of course, part of all this whole story is after Passover is the giving of the Ten Commandments, the law by God personally to Moses on Mount Sinai. But that's later on in the book of Exodus. In the narrative of Exodus, the Bible says that God helped the children of Israel escape from their slavery in Egypt by inflicting 10 plagues upon the ancient Egyptians before the Pharaoh would release his Israelite slaves. The 10th and worst of the plagues was the death of the Egyptian firstborn. Serious, very serious. I guess he was too stupid to see the writing on the wall. The Israelites were instructed to mark the doorposts of their homes with the blood of a slaughtered spring lamb, and upon seeing this, the Spirit of the Lord knew to pass over, get it? Pass over the firstborn in these homes, hence the English name of the holiday. I was told by somebody who is a professor of the history of religion at Columbia, who is also Jewish, that there are other earlier, much earlier blood sacrifices that resemble this around the same time of the year during spring. Blood sacrifices to Yahweh, to the Lord. And this may have gotten mixed in with Passover. Nevertheless, this is the story of Passover. But here's what's interesting, too, and which ties all these holidays together, Passover and Easter, both these holidays. Historically, together with Shavuot and Sukkot, Passover is one of the three pilgrimage festivals during which the entire population, including, depending on your belief, of course, including Jesus of Nazareth, who would have been part of the population back in the day, the whole kingdom of Judah, if they could do it, made a pilgrimage to the temple in Jerusalem. So this is Passover is one of the days. So that's what he was doing there when he was arrested, tortured, and crucified. That's what Jesus was doing there, along with other Jews. He had a special message to deliver at the time, and he had a special mission to fulfill, according to the Christian Bible. But that's what he was doing in Jerusalem at the time. In the neighborhood I grew up in, I was thinking about this today, and I recall very clearly, it was a mixture of the original inhabitants were the Indians, of course, but after that were Christians, various kinds of Methodists, Presbyterians, and some Catholics, but it was mostly Methodists, Presbyterians, and maybe some Baptists, but it was mostly the first two. And there were some Catholics in part of the town. But so separated were the people there. These people were the Jews who came there. It was mostly Jews afterwards. Jews came in after the Methodists and Presbyterians, who had been there since, well, you know, originally the Dutch had farms there, but later on it was Germans that settled there, and then some Irish, but they were Irish Protestants, but mostly German Protestants. But then came a huge influx after World War II with the GI Bill and being able to buy really low-cost housing, a huge influx of Jews settled in Laurelton, in Queens, way out in the edge of Queens there where I grew up. And this is in the, like I say, in the late, in the early, mid to late 40s, in the early 50s. And it was, there was two synagogues, no, actually three synagogues, if you count the Orthodox synagogue. So, but there were churches there. And so separate were these two communities because they came from this generation, that's my parents' generation, and they also brought along their parents, which would be my grandparents' generation. They were so separate from each other, these groups of people, the Christians and the Jews, especially the Jews from the Christians. Maybe I shouldn't say especially, but they were strangers to each other. And the two very, very rarely intermixed. They were neighbors with each other. They were neighbors, and they could be good neighbors to each other. But their social lives, and certainly their religious lives, obviously, never mixed. And when I was growing up, a lot of us were brought up by our grandparents who were immigrants from Eastern Europe and had a feeling about Christianity that went anywhere from unpleasantly neutral to outright hatred. And so it's ironic when you think about it, when you add up all the cultural wars that went on and all the religious wars that are still going on, you know, everywhere. But what went on out there in Queens in the 1940s and 50s and into the 60s was that, of course, the Jews were considered by the Christians to be still a suspect race, only interested in making money, whatever stupid, vicious, ignorant, bigoted stereotype you can think of. That's how the Christians looked at the Jews. But that's exactly the way the Jews looked at the Christians. People were taught by people from my grandmother's generation who were immigrants, who had been the victims of pogroms, which is, I think, a Russian word, being actually mass murders and burning down of whole villages and slaughtering of huge groups of people in cities and towns, Jews, by mostly Russians, sometimes other countries in Eastern Europe, but mostly the Russian government, with the approval and with the urging of the Russian priests and the Russian government. It was insane, violent anti-Semitism all over Europe, of course, naturally, if you've read any history, for about 1,000, maybe almost 1,500 years, but close to 1,000 years. And it was terrible in Russia and Eastern Europe, worse there than anywhere else. Later on, of course, Nazi Germany. But the Nazis inherited this hatred of Jews from Martin Luther, who, like any good medieval, Dark Ages or medieval Christian, suspected Jews of being in league with the devil and, of course, of being a race, no matter when it was, that was responsible for murdering Christ. But so separate were they. So when I was growing up, we were brought up, we weren't even look at a church. If we passed by a church, when I think about how separate and ignorant and narrow-minded we all were on both sides, right? We wouldn't even look at a church. And to go inside a church, for a Jew to go inside a church, you might as well have written letters beforehand saying goodbye to your whole family because you would never be seen again. You would go straight to some horrible place, maybe hell. Well, the Jews didn't believe in a hell. The Jews don't have a hell, as far as I know. Not a vivid, you know, burning, punishing hell like the Christians have. But you didn't even look at a church. You felt uncomfortable if you were Jewish and growing up when I did, brought up by my grandmother's generation, and not my parents. My parents' generation were second generation. They considered themselves American Jews. Americans who were Jews, or maybe Jewish Americans. But my grandmother's generation, and there were plenty of them who moved out there to be with their children out in the, basically to them was the country. Sometimes they would refer to it as the country, from people who had grown up in the Lower East Side and in the inner city, in the tough tenements, you know, who landed there when they immigrated and grew up there. They had a hatred of and a fear of, righteously come by the way, of all Christians, and particularly Catholics, and I'll talk about that in a little while. So you didn't go, you walked past a church, but if you could almost, if you could pretend it wasn't there, or if you didn't look at it, it would be better. Sometimes I would look at a church, and I have to say, this is the way I was brought up. I mean, I didn't really know anything about this. I mean, I'm living in total ignorance. Like most bigotry, like most prejudice, it was based on total ignorance. So, you know, you didn't even look at one. And you didn't go in a church. You did not go in a church. And like I say, even though we all, the neighbors were intermixed, all the, you know, the Catholic, what Catholics there were, or the Protestants, were mixed in with the Jews all through the entire neighborhood where I lived, especially the 10 or 20 block area where I lived in this neighborhood. It was like a little town by itself. And, you know, they would sit with each other on their lawns in the summer or in the spring. When 4th of July came, they would celebrate with fireworks together. They would talk to each other about, you know, planting and about their flowers, and they talk over the back fences. They would borrow cups of sugar from each other, or chicken fat, or whatever it is that they wanted. But when it came to religion, everybody kept their mouth shut. Nobody said anything, because it was the, what do they call Social Security? The third rail of American politics, or it used to be, or I hope it keeps being. Anyhow, but religion you just didn't bring up, because their attitude towards Jews, it went without saying, right? And of course, that's not everybody. There were exceptions, and they would talk about it. There were some people who were atheists, you know, although they were nominally of a certain religion, they were atheists, or they were at least agnostics, and did not go to church, did not go to synagogue, and they could afford to be closer neighbors and talk about religion sometimes. But, you know, it came Christmas time. You could always tell exactly who was who, except for the few people who did not put any lights out, or you couldn't see a tree inside their living room window. And that's where people had their trees, was in the living room, in the front of the house. Most of these houses were the same. If you didn't see a tree and you didn't see any lights, that was either an unbeliever or a Jew who lived in that abode. But if you saw lights and you saw, you know, obviously you saw a tree, then Christians. And that's during holidays, that's when it came out. That's when you could see it. And on the two big holidays of Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, you would see all the Jews walking on the street, because nobody in those days, nobody would use, this is like the Sabbath for really religious Jews. On those 2 days, people who were Jews who weren't religious most of the year would not listen to the radio, would not answer the phone, would not use anything electronic, would not drive in a car. So you would see them dressed up in their best clothes, walking on the streets to back and forth to visit each other, and also to the synagogue. But basically, never the twain did meet back in those days. And it was a strange thing. And the reason I mention all this is because I had to be at least a teenager, if not actually in my 20s. As hard as this is to believe, I had to be at least a teenager or in my 20s before I understood what Easter really was. I had no idea. I mean, I knew very little about Jesus. I knew, because like I said, we didn't talk about religion. And I didn't really know who Jesus was, except vaguely. If I studied him in school, if I studied the story of Jesus in school, the story of Jesus, right? But to, just the word Jesus, which occasionally I would hear, you know, some of my parents' generation, if they were cursing, they would say, hit their head. If they're on the roof of the building and they were trying to fix the roof or something, and knocking in some more tar paper or painting, and they accidentally hit themselves with a hammer or something, they'd say, Jesus Christ, or if they were disgusted with somebody, right? Usually Jews didn't say that. They would say, God damn it. Or if it was an old enough of a generation, they would say something in Yiddish, a curse in Yiddish. But I didn't know anything about Jesus. We didn't go in churches. We didn't talk to Christians. We had friends we played with. The Jews generally played with the Jews, and the Christians played with the Christians. So, and the Christian kids, when you did play with them, they occasionally would say something about Jews. There were incidents where Jews were attacked for being Jews. But this came during a certain time of the year. It came during Easter. It came during Easter. And I never really understood that till later on. And the first time I found out about who Jesus was or what Easter was, it was all just pagan, strange, creepy gobbledygook to the Jewish kids when we were growing up. And I didn't know a damn thing about it. As far as the Seder goes, and the religion entirely, my entire religious upbringing and the Passover Seders, which I participated in until I was 15, were all held together by my grandmother. My grandmother was the one who kept all this going. If it wasn't for her, there wouldn't, the rest of my family, my uncles, my aunts, my mother was, seriously mentally ill, so she didn't really care one way or the other. Or she kept her house kosher. My house was kosher when I was growing up. My grandmother was kosher, and she celebrated the holidays, and she put together a Passover Seder. But the last time I've been at a Seder, I was in my mid-30s, and I went over to a friend, my wife's ex-wife's friend's house. They were Jewish and they had a Seder. But before that, the last Seder was when I was 15, and all this fell apart. All of this observance of religion or religious rituals anyhow fell apart after my grandmother died. The whole thing fell apart. And because the rest of my family was not religious, I lived right next door to my aunt. My aunt lived next door to me, and they were completely non-kosher. My house was kosher, but if we wanted to have shrimp or bacon in the morning, or if we wanted to have pork chops, or we wanted to have a ham sandwich, we'd go next door. So it was kind of silly, It made you feel like, what's the point? In my house, we grew up kosher. One thing was when you're kosher is you do not mix milk and meat. Do not mix milk and meat in any way. So we never had anything like a cheeseburger, or we never had anything like manicotti. You just didn't do that. You didn't have a glass of milk with your roast beef sandwich. In fact, it was something that we learned as children and that we observed every day. We didn't observe it, but that's how we were brought up, that it actually would make us sick. And to this day, I can't eat milk and meat together, although I can't eat dairy anyhow these days. I have a lot of trouble with that. But I could never eat milk and meat together. If I got pizza, for instance, way into my adult years when I was still eating pizza, if I had a last meal, if somebody said, that's it, you've got one more meal left, you're condemned, you've had it, we're going to pull a switch on you for some crime or you're dying of cancer, the last meal I'd have was pizza. I would ask for pizza. It shows you how refined my tastes are. I miss having pizza. I haven't had pizza in like 15 years because of the gluten and gluten and the cheese and everything else. I would love to have a piece of pizza. Oh, where was I? Anyhow. So my aunt right next door, completely non-kosher, but so kosher, where we were growing up that during Passover, you clean up the whole house, you get a thorough cleaning, mostly the kitchen, and you substitute a whole set of dishes and silverware, especially for Passover, for the regular dishes and silverware you use. And all these rituals, I have no idea what they meant. And we had a Seder. Like I said, my grandmother had a Seder for Passover. And she sent me to a Hebrew school where I was supposed to learn about my religion because, as far as my grandmother was concerned, although she had friends who were, associates or colleagues or friends, she was a teacher once, who were Christians, she came from a world where Jews stayed together for their own survival. And but we were never taught anything. We were never taught the meaning of the rituals of the Seder. We did read from a book, I guess, the Haggadah, it's called. And we did participate in the rituals, but it was a very light, L-I-T-E, Seder. It only lasted for like an hour or two, and it was not the big, long Seder that people have these days. But it all fell apart there. And I never knew if my grandmother, so my grandmother kept this all together for other reasons, but I never knew if she was really religious. I never knew if she was really religious or prayed or believed in God. I have a feeling she wasn't. She had a very cynical sort of intellectual attitude about things, but she did come from the old country. And I have no idea whether or not she was religious. I never really asked her. I never really got involved in it. Certainly my parents weren't religious. My mother wasn't religious. And my father was an out-and-out atheist. He came from another, group of Jews who were descendants of communists and anarchists, people from Russia and then the Lower East Side. And he had nothing but contempt for all religions, but unfortunately, particularly for his own. He had no belief in religion whatsoever. But my grandmother did it because she was continuing her family tradition. She was continuing from the old world to preserve this survival mode of Jews. They kept their religion. The religion is what kept it going. And Yiddish were the two things that kept it going. The language, they spoke Yiddish in the old world and here in the new world and kept speaking it, even though they could speak English, some of them fluently, like my grandmother. But also they, it was the idea of keeping the Jewish community together to preserve it, because the religion and the language is what kept it together. It was the glue that kept it together. Like in most religions, only in an extreme form, and most religions are kept together by the communal aspect of it, by the early Christians and Christians to this day. The communal aspect, celebrating or participating or praying, no matter what you believe or not, together in families, gathering in a house of worship or praying together in families. And you can't separate the two things. You can't separate that for Jews. It was an extreme thing with the Jews. There was no way to divide the religion and the survival of it. In other words, if you were Christian in America, you didn't have to worry so much in the 20th century, at least, or in the late 19th century. You didn't have to worry so much about literally surviving, but huddling together, circling the wagons, was important to do if you were Jewish. And, it's in a world that has been trying, that had been trying, and looks like it still is again, ramping it up, trying to destroy the Jews, that hated the Jews and tried to destroy them. Humiliations, constant bigotry, anti-Semitism, torture. I mean, this goes back, like 1,000 years, forced conversions, random and planned murders and destruction and mass murders, Inquisition, pogroms, massacres, like I said, the Nazis, and now the Islamic fundamentalists. And a lot of the Islamic fundamentalists, you can't really detach what's going on now in Israel, with Israel and the Palestinians and its neighbors, from this terrible ancient heritage of anti-Semitism. A lot of the madrasas that are funded by the Saudis have textbooks that refer to the Jews, that Jews, you understand, not Israelis, as pigs. Mohammed, tried, the first people that Mohammed tried to convert after he received the message, after he received the Quran, the holy word of the Quran from Allah, the first people he tried to convert in Mecca, where there was a large community of them, were the Jews. But he had no luck at all, basically just stirred up a lot of hostility, which explains, believe me, a lot going back. The Jews, a lot of people around Mecca and Medina and Saudi Arabia, and then later on, as it spread and became a huge empire, converted either willingly or unwillingly. They were converted by the sword. But the Jews would never convert, no matter what. And they then stirred up, as they did in other places. They were never part of the larger community, and they were seen as obviously as the outsiders because they refused to give up their religion and convert to the predominant religion, even in the face of death sometimes. Although sometimes there were forced conversions. Some Jews did convert or were forced to convert on pain of death or losing all their possessions or being kicked out of countries. And they were kicked out of countries anyway. But I think a lot of this Islamic hatred and violence towards the Jews has the same roots as good old-fashioned externalizing, projecting anti-Semitism. In other words, they, the eternal other, the Jews and the Israelis, they're responsible for all your troubles, all your crazy. This is what I think people get told in Islamic countries. You know, all the poverty, all the murderous monarchs, and all the vicious dictators, and the insane people that run these countries, and the fundamentalists. All these people, they tell the people that their poverty and their misery and the backwardness of their laws and all of this is the fault of the Jews. Same way the Nazis did it. And the same kind of discrimination that happened throughout centuries, you know, everything was blamed on the Jews. The plague, you know, bad droughts. And, you know, somehow this is not a case closed deal here. You could see this is still happening. It's still happening that the Jews and it's hard to mix up the to conflate. I don't like that word usually, but to conflate the Israelis and the Jews, right? It's hard to separate them and it's hard to combine them. But a lot of stuff is blamed on the Jews in the Middle East by Islamic fundamentalists and by the governments of these countries urging their people on, and by these unofficial governments like ISIS or Al-Qaeda and all these other places blame the Jews and assassinate Jews and burn down synagogues and blow up cafes where Jews are in various countries in the Middle East and now in Europe and other places. And it's just old-fashioned anti-Semitism. It's using them as a way. It's ignorant, usually young people being told that this is the way to these are the villains. These are the evil ones. This is the way to avenge your misery. And this kind of, and the Jews have been on the bad end of the stick of this for more than 1,000 years. And my grandmother taught this all to us. And this is something that, living in the United States now as a third generation Jew and having, you know, many Christian friends and being married to somebody who is at least nominally a Christian, is something that it took me a tremendous amount of time and effort in a way to unburden myself of this kind of narrow-minded bigotry. Because this misery, although Passover has many joyous aspects to it, after all, it's a freedom from slavery, this misery is something that's an inherited part of Jews from most of the world. And only after World War II did this start to alleviate. And in this country, that's why a lot of people wanted to come to this country, because it just didn't, they didn't, this place was not steeped in it for like 1,000 years, like most of Europe was. And a lot of people are thinking about leaving Europe now and going to Israel for the same reason, or coming to America, possibly, to emigrate to the United States, because of all this thousands and thousands of years, hundreds and hundreds of years of misery and you know, discrimination against the Jews. And it's scary to see, as a Jew, that it still continues. Why don't we take a little musical break here, and we'll be back in a bit. you know, it Passover, obviously Passover, a celebration of the liberation from slavery, has, as I say, many joyous aspects to it. You know, it's remembering a time in slavery, but it's remembering more precisely the liberation from slavery. And but it's a holiday that that is involved with a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of slaughter and nastiness and violence involved. I mean, after all, this is a revolution, and this is by the hand of the Lord through Moses. And but still a joyous liberation. Obviously, you know the story. You've seen the movie, The Ten Commandments. You know where Pharaoh changes his mind after he lets the slaves go. I mean, after all, who's going to take care? Who's going to build everything? Same story with the blacks down south. Who's going to build everything? Who's going to do all the scut work? Who's going to do all the work for nothing? Right? Does that mean the actual Egyptians are going to have to build their own buildings, make their own food, clean their own toilets? Horrible. So he gets in his chariot and tries to chase them all down and get them back, and or at least wreak vengeance on them. But, the Lord allows the Jews to cross the Red Sea, and then the Red Sea comes in on Yul Brynner and all the other Egyptians. Dirty bastards who deserved it, right? But still, Jews came to America, my grandmother's generation, but they experienced a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism in America. It wasn't, mass murders and pogroms, and their houses weren't burned down, but they were discriminated against. They were beat up by certain parts of the population, and that's when they ran into particular different kinds. That's when they started discriminating between different kinds of Christians, and I mean distinguishing, rather, between different kinds of Christians. The most violent Christians they ran into who would come after them because they were Jews were the Catholics, and usually the Irish Catholics. But it was, they couldn't get into, Jews came here, and even in my father's generation, which is, 30s and 40s, they still couldn't get into, they couldn't get advancement in certain jobs. They got so far in certain companies and they couldn't get any further. There were certain colleges they weren't allowed into, certain clubs in colleges they weren't allowed into. So this kind of discrimination went on still here. And it went on way into the 1950s and 60s. But by the time I was coming of age, by the time I was a teenager, you didn't really get that so much. And one of the great benefits of the New Deal, which is why all the Jews were, 99% of the Jews were so crazy about Roosevelt and the New Deal, was the whole idea of the civil service and the merit system. I mean, first of all, there were free schools in the United States, even before Roosevelt, the advent of Roosevelt. And this was astounding to the Jews, that they could come here and get a free education and not be discriminated against. Yeah, they could endure nasty words and the occasional, schoolyard beat down. But, and maybe the teachers were anti-Semitic, but they still were able to have free schools. And then the civil service. Yeah, fantastic. It didn't matter who you knew. You didn't have to be a friend of some politician or something to get anywhere, to get a job at all. All these ward healers and all that kind of thing. But the civil service was a great boon to the Jews because it was all based on merit. You took a test and you rose up through the ranks based on tests and based on merit. And that's how it worked. And later on, the blacks benefited from that too. My grandmother, as I say, was a graduate of free college, which was unknown back where she came from. Graduated from Hunter College in New York City. My father graduated from City College. My mother also from Hunter College. Most of my relatives who went to college graduated from free colleges. They didn't have the money to pay for, for regular private schools. But still this kind of stuff went on. What I experienced out in Easter, and this is what I understood about Jesus and Easter, and it was not a good thing, was that on Easter, and this is stuff we never understood until later on, right? And what would happen was that there was a community next door to our community. It was an Irish Catholic community called Rosedale, which was right next to Laurelton. And every year, as it had been going on for 1,000 years, but it still only survived in Irish Catholic churches. For some reason, the Italians didn't make such a big deal about this. But the Irish Catholics, the priests and the nuns, Irish Catholic priests and nuns, actually preached sermons about the Jews killing Christ during Easter. Who killed Christ? This is during Passover, you understand, and Easter, that's why they go together. Christ was, Jesus was in Jerusalem, you know, making his holy pilgrimage to the holy city, you know, and he, you know, he was, there was some, there was one segment, some of the high priests considered him a revolutionary and an apostate, blasphemous, and they wanted him out of the way, and they persuaded the Romans to do their work for them. And when Christ was arrested, when Jesus was arrested, he was arrested by, if I remember the story right, he was arrested by Roman soldiers and temple guards. The priests had a real racket there. The high priests of Jerusalem had a real racket. They took in a tremendous amount of money for sacrifices and blessings. I mean, it was a terrible racket that they had. And they were very snobby, arrogant. They were rich. And any kind of person like Jesus, who was a kind of revolutionary of the people, was seen as a terrible threat to their power. They couldn't tolerate that. But they didn't want to eliminate him, as the story goes, because he was very much a man of the people. He was a man who was preaching to regular people and saying that these people, you know, and then you get through the whole story of Christ and Passover and Jesus and Judaism. But the still, in the 1950s, you know, like in the mid-1950s, I was 11, 12, 13 years old. During time of Easter, the priests would preach sermons saying that the Jews killed our Lord. You understand, they weren't saying that 2,000 years ago, some Jews persuaded the Romans to arrest and torture and crucify Jesus Christ of Nazareth 2,000 years ago. No, the Jews, which includes every one of us right then and there who lived in my neighborhood. So I was as good a murderer, I was as much a murderer of Jesus Christ as a temple priest or a soldier of the temple 2,000 years before. And this is these lunk-headed Irish teenagers, and the nuns would tell them too. The nuns would say, the Jews, who and they would point in our direction, I'm sure, who lived in our neighborhood. And you can find them very easily by going right over there to that neighborhood, right next door to you. They killed Christ. And they'd come over and they'd beat up Jews. They'd say, you know, they'd kike, Christ killer, whatever it is they heard from their, from these bigoted, twisted, suppressed lunatics who were running their religion over there in Rosedale. You could see my attitude, right? Because we were on the end of this, these beatdowns, and they'd come over during Easter, right? During the time, and they would come over during Passover. One time they came over during Passover, and actually stood outside my synagogue and threw a couple of rocks through the windows. Only they were picking on the wrong Jews. They were picking on the wrong Jews in the wrong generation. The Jewish guys in my synagogue were guys who grew up in tough neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods on the Lower East Side, like my father. And a lot of them were combat vets and lived through the Depression and had to struggle, you know, and make their way in the world. And a lot of them were combat vets from World War II. And they just streamed out of the synagogue. All of the rabbis said, no, 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 no. He didn't want any violence, you know. He was trying to keep the whole thing together, but he couldn't stop these guys. It was too much for them. They didn't fight World War II. They didn't grow up in the Lower East Side giving and taking beatings and being afraid of Irish Catholics on the Lower East Side in Manhattan. And they didn't fight the Nazis to put up with this crap. So they streamed out of there, and a lot of us went outside to watch them. And it was, I have to say, it was a very cheering sight, although it was nasty to look at, that they turned these Irish kids, you know, big, lunk-headed, beefy kind of Irish teenage guys, maybe anywhere from 15 through 19, they turned them into hospital cases in a matter of minutes. The cops showed up finally, and all the cops were Irish. The cops showed up. Nobody was arrested. They called an ambulance for some of the worst cases. They took the other ones and put them in a car, and no charges were ever preferred against anybody. People understood that that's what went on. But the idea of of Israel, you know, the Holy Land, which ultimately is where Moses took the Jews after wandering 40 years in the desert. The idea of Israel was always such a glorious thing because of things like this. I mean, even the anti-Semitism that my grandparents and my parents' generation experienced was something that that they put up with. But for, you know, for since they were driven out of their land, you know, the Israel in 2,000 years ago, whatever it was, by the Romans, and since the temple was burned down, the Jews in the diaspora had always prayed. They'd always said, next year in Jerusalem, they wanted to go back to the Holy Land, to the Promised Land. And then the idea of all these, the Jews being completely helpless all the time, of being, having no one to protect them, no one to stand up for them, having no legal rights whatsoever anywhere, forced conversions again, humiliations, massacres, anti-Semitism, ghettos that were established, rapes, theft, mass theft of all their possessions, and culminating in the 20th century, which is not so long ago. You know, was it like 70 years ago now that that happened? Culminating 60 years ago, culminating in all of this, the Jews didn't have a place of their own. And so for religious reasons and for mostly for political and reasons of survival, they wanted to have a land of their own. Of course, the land that they wanted was the one that they had originally inhabited and had their own kingdom. The kingdom of Judah, the kingdom of Palestine. This is the one they wanted. Now, I was riding in a car the other day with a guy who was a Palestinian. And I've been in a car with this guy before. Once in a while, I could take a car service if I save up my pennies from the piggy bank. And this guy is a terrific guy, a really nice guy who is extremely religious Muslim. And this was a few days ago, and he said, is there a big Jewish holiday coming up? And I said, yeah, Passover. And he says, so what's the holiday? So I'm explaining to him. I said, it's when Moses led the Jews out of Egypt, where they were slaves, and then he led them to the Promised Land. And I said, well, then maybe that wasn't such good news for you. Maybe that's not such good news for you. I mean, Moses led the Jews to the Promised Land, and he had to wander. The Jews had to wander in the desert for 40 years, and there was a reason for that. They didn't go, on Amtrak or first class or business class straight to the Promised Land after they crossed the Red Sea. They wandered for 40 years. And one of the reasons for that, as I dimly understand, like I said in the beginning, I have a very poor understanding of my own Bible stories from the Old Testament, of my own religion. But the reason that I understand that they wandered for 40 years in the desert was so that the Jews who had been brought up in slavery and the Jews who had not actually understood that really there was the Lord God, who had turned their backs on the Lord and who were given to hedonism, who weren't obeying or playing by the rules, the ones who didn't obey the rule of God's law, and the ones who were used to being slaves, died off during that time. And I think that was the point of it, that they wandered for 40 years, not because, it wouldn't take 40 years to get from Egypt to Palestine, right? But why did they wander for 40 years, and why did they have to struggle so much? Well, they struggled for various reasons. One is that the lesson is that when you are relieved from slavery, it's almost like hitting bottom, right? If you're an alcoholic, when you're relieved from slavery, it's not all free after that. It's not all easy after that. Something I'm, still learning in my life. You have to work all the time to leave that behind you and to overcome it. And you work every day at it, right? But for 40 years, that entire generation of people who had understood nothing but being slaves and who had not paid attention to the will and the laws and the rules of God as given to Moses and then as given to the people, died off. And so you had a new generation who arrived in the Holy Land, the Promised Land. Unfortunately, there's no way you can get around it. The Promised Land had people living in it. which is the original problem here, which we're still dealing with right now. I mean, but we were so proud of Israel when we were kids. My grandmother, I was only 4 years old when the state of Israel was declared a state by the UN, and then a big war ensued, actually 3.5, 4 years old. And but then the war of 1956, and then was it the 1965 war, the 1966 war, Yom Kippur war, Jews who had been picked on and demonized and beaten over in Eastern Europe and then on the Lower East Side and been discriminated against in this country. And people like my father who had trouble getting into medical school. He never did make it into medical school, but there were various reasons for that. One of them was, though, that there were quotas in medical schools and various graduate schools on Jews. And that's one reason why he didn't make it in and didn't have any connections. So all of these Jews who had experienced all this and had watched the Nazis exterminate 6 million of their relatives and all these Jews in Europe, they were so thrilled. The words cannot express how thrilled they were that there was a state of Israel. Finally, the Jews, after wandering for thousands of years, after being being the evil ones, the associates of the devil, after being trampled on for thousands of years. And it was all considered absolutely glorious. I mean, it was considered the most glorious thing in the world. And my grandmother and my parents' generation, they were so proud that there was a state of Israel. And a lot of us were too. You know, I mean, you know, if you had to deal with kids on the playground, every once in a while you'd deal with some lunkhead on the playground saying, Jew this, Jew bastard that, they'd throw a basketball at your face, or, people that had get into fights and usually get beat up, because these guys were much fonder of fighting and better at it than most of the Jewish kids I knew. The Jewish kids I knew generally were, except for the ones who were the athletes, and there was a couple of tough guys, Jews who I knew, they were generally brought up to be scholars, that being the acknowledged way, the understood way for generations, and still is, of course, of getting ahead in the world. Not there were tough Jews in the 20s and 30s, you know, from the Lower East Side. There was a time when there was a lot of good Jewish boxers who were champions in the 20s and then later on in the 30s. But and then there was a lot of Jewish gangsters too, tough guys, you know, like Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel. But after the 40s and 50s, the Jews settled down and dedicated themselves to something they had always dedicated themselves to, was scholarship. And fighting was just not in the cards. It wasn't something you were raised to do, or that you were considered that it was considered a wonderful thing if you beat the crap out of somebody else. It was considered like just something that that they did. Get it? That's what they did. What you did was you studied and you learned, and that's so. And we were all tired of that. And when we saw the Israelis win in 1956 and 66, I think it was, or was it 67? We were all very proud of them. It was only later on, and as the world began to understand, and as the information came out, and as we studied these things, and as the news was allowed to report these things, that we understood what had happened to a lot of the Palestinians, the way the Palestinians had been treated. And it was obviously continues to this day, you know, the 1948, where they were chased out of a lot of their settlements and everything. It was a bad thing. It was a bad thing, and it still is a bad thing. And now it's much more complicated. The Jews are very divided. Jews in America are very divided about Israel. But again, Passover. The story of Passover is a story of escape from slavery. It's a story of escaping a tyrant, Pharaoh. And one of the all of these religious holidays, and Christians, Judaism, you know, Muslims, whatever, they all have spiritual or moral and philosophical lessons attached to them. They're not just stories from the Bible or from history, or maybe from history. But the idea of one thing, as I mentioned before, is that once you get out of slavery, you still have a huge, long struggle to go. You have to wander sometimes for a long time, and you have to work at it to get out of this feeling of slavery, and also to escape the tyrant, to escape the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh, the tyrant, is sometimes not just some man, you know, who's, I mean, if it's externalized, if it's an externalized tyrant, you can clearly see that somebody who's a dictator or a monarch or somebody like Joe McCarthy in this country or somebody. But you have to wander in sometimes in your own desert to form fighting in your mind and your spirit to form a new self, or at least transcend the chains that were formed when you were young. The tyrant can be yourself. The tyrant can be yourself that you have to liberate yourself from. The internal bondage is something that's deeper and more unforgiving. It's the bondage of your own mind. It's the tyrant in your own mind that you learned these things when you were a kid to be enslaved by your own fears and your own prejudices and your own self-hatreds and your own hatreds of other people and your own worries and your own doubts. And this is the bondage that's the hardest bondage to free yourself from. So during Passover, one of the great messages is that you have to struggle. It's a huge, long struggle to free yourself from slavery. All right, that's it for this week. I will see you next week.
Go down,
Moses,
where?